You're listening to live courtroom coverage of the trial of Lori Vallow Daybell from the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today. Now, back to the courtroom.
Come right up here and be sworn in. Just stand here.
Can you spell your name for the record?
I do. My name is William McDonald, W-I-L-L-I-A-M, McDonald, M-C-D-O-N-A-L-D.
Thank you.
Over here and have a seat to my left.
Do you please introduce yourself to the jury?
Hi, good afternoon. My name is William McDonald. I am a retired police officer with the city of Chandler.
What are you currently doing?
I am currently teaching criminal justice at Williams Field High School in Gilbert, Arizona.
So you told us you previously worked for the Chandler Police Department. How long were you with them?
I was with the Chandler Police Department for approximately 22 years. I'm sorry, 26 years.
Oh, that's a big difference. When did you retire?
I retired in November of 2022.
Okay. What can you tell us what your different jobs were at the Chandler Police Department?
As with all officers with the Chandler Police Department, I started off in patrol. I worked a patrol position for about 18 months, after which I switched over to more of a community services team. I spent 2 years with that team, after which I transferred to detectives and spent the remainder of my career in detectives, working primarily internet crimes against children and digital forensics.
Can you talk to us about specifically your training and education relating to extractions of cell phones?
When it comes to cell phones, I have extensive training in the use of the software that we use to extract that data. I am certified in the use of the Cellebrite suite, which is one of the primary tools that we would use to extract data and organize data extracted from the cell phones. I was also trained, although they did not have a certification process, in several other platforms used with cell phones.
Did you ever go to any type of digital evidence examiner courses?
Absolutely. Beginning in 2001, when I began working digital forensics, I attended numerous courses on digital forensics, hundreds of hours worth of training, and I hold several certifications in digital forensics related to computers and, as previously discussed, cell phones.
So by 2019, what were your duties at that time at the Chandler Police Department?
By 2019, my primary duties were to conduct digital forensics examinations on computers and cell phones. I was also responsible for training new members to the Computer Crimes Unit, in addition to assisting with Internet Crimes Against Children investigations.
In your role, were you regularly asked then to examine cell phones and try to extract data from them?
Yes, I was.
Can you talk us through, if you are handed a cell phone, what do you do?
Once we received the cell phone, and we would usually be given additional information at the time, usually from the case agent or the investigating detective, such as if there was a search warrant involved or anything like that, we would review the search warrant, make sure we had legal authority to do whatever it was they were asking us to do. We would then obtain the cell phone or whatever item we wanted to examine. My process was to start by taking pictures of the phone or the device prior to removing it from any evidence packaging. Once those pictures were taken, I would remove the cell phone from the packaging, take additional pictures to document condition of the device. Once the pictures were taken, I would attempt to power on the device to make sure that it had been placed in airplane mode, which would prevent any additional changes being made or outside people being able to access the device to make changes while it was in our possession. If it was in airplane mode, I would then attach it to whatever piece of software or hardware we were going to use to copy or extract the information from the phone. Once that process completed, which you would usually create just a single file, which for most of us would be meaningless, it was just a container file. And by a container file, I mean a file similar to, if you think like a box. The container file is the box. Initially, that box is empty, and we can put additional files inside of it. These container files would then be entered into, usually we would use the Cellebrite software, as we did in this case. And that software would kind of go through the box and put everything in an organized manner, a manner in which people could read it and make sense of what that information was. We would then create a report, which we would provide to the case agents, and that would pretty much conclude our involvement. We would finalize everything by taking everything that we created, all of our files, all of our reports, notes, pictures, everything, and we would store them on an archive server at the Chandler Police Department.
All right. I'm going to go through a couple different words you said and have you explain them for us, all right?
Certainly.
So starting with first, extraction. What does that mean?
Simply put, extraction means we are copying the information on the phone to another device, say a thumb drive or another hard drive or something that we have prepared forensically, which means it contains no data.
So when we're talking about extraction from, say, a phone, you're talking about you're copying contact lists and text messages and photos and emails or search histories, anything that we have on our cell phone.
Correct.
Okay. Can extraction of a cell phone include GPS or locating data?
It can.
When you have extracted this, you talked about it not being in a format that people can understand. Can you talk to us just a little bit more about that?
So essentially these single files, when we have copied or extracted the information from the cell phone, it creates this single container file where all of the information is in there. That information is in the form of database files, other proprietary type files, that without appropriate software or specific software to actually be able to read that information, it would be extremely difficult to piece it back together manually.
And so that's what you said, the Cellbrite software helps to put that in a way that we can read it?
That is correct.
So when you use the Cellbrite system, does that put the data together, like all of the text messages are now together and all of the emails are now together?
Yes, ma'am.
Rather than just being jumbled everywhere, basically.
Correct. It will put text lines together. It will extract date and time information. As you mentioned previously, it can extract GPS and location information. It will extract pictures, and it puts all of those together so that like items are together.
Are you responsible for reviewing or analyzing whatever it is that you extract?
No.
Are you solely responsible for trying to extract the data from a phone, ensuring that that process goes correctly and that it is then parsed into data that lay people can read?
Yes, ma'am. When we extract the data from phones or computers or whatever digital medium we're working with, we follow forensically sound procedures to ensure that that data is not changed at any point along the process.
And so you said you also keep the original data file that you extract in a server so that if anyone wants to look at that, they can do that again?
Correct.
And then the phone itself, does it alter the phone in any way when you do this process? Is it blank after that?
Our process should not change any of the information on the phone. However, with cell phones, because they do need to be on during this process, some system files can change.
So it could add more data to it potentially?
Potentially, yes.
All right, so on July 16th of 2019, did you receive a request from a detective in Klan to examine an Apple iPhone that was impounded as item CH131035? And if I can have my paralegal approach with Exhibit 245.
Yes, this is consistent with the item I received.
Were you provided with a PIN to access that phone?
We were.
Okay. And what was the PIN you were provided to access that phone?
The PIN was 0000.
All right. Pretty easy to remember. And if you can bring that back. What day did you begin the extraction process?
I believe, if I recall correctly, it was July 17th.
So the next day.
Yes, ma'am.
You told us that you first get the phone and you are both documenting it and sort of noting it. I'm going to show you, and if I can have my paralegal approach with Exhibits 180 through 185 that have been shown to defense counsel. Are you familiar with those photographs?
Yes, these are consistent with the types of photographs that I would take.
And those related to this review of this cell phone 245?
Yes.
State will move to admit 180 through 185.
Any objection?
No objection.
180 through 185 are admitted.
And if I can have the Elmo. Thank you. Why do you take photos of the phone as you're processing it?
Primarily, we take photos of the phone to document condition. I will also take photographs of the item while it is still in the evidence packaging to document how it was packaged, and if there are any evidence seals, what the condition of those seals are.
All right. So in this, when we talked about a item number, is that what we were talking about, the CH131035?
Correct.
Okay. And that's Exhibit 180 and 181. What are we seeing here?
That is a photograph of the front screen of what appears to be an iPhone X, I believe, or XS Max.
You get this phone, and I put 182. It's turned off initially when you get it.
In this case, this particular phone was powered on when I received it.
Okay, but the screen was blank, but still it was powered on.
Correct.
Was it in airplane mode, and why does that matter?
Yes, it was in airplane mode, and you can see that from looking at the upper right-hand corner of the phone screen, where it's got the little airplane icon. And this is important because while a phone is in airplane mode, it will prevent outside sources from connecting in and prevent the phone from connecting to the cellular network or to any wireless networks, which will help secure the data that's on the phone to prevent any changes or from anybody from the outside accessing the device.
Do you check when you get a phone like this to see if there's a SIM card in there?
I do.
What is a SIM card?
A SIM card is a subscriber. It's short for subscriber identity module, and it's basically a little card that's inside the phone that holds certain subscriber information. It can hold contact lists. It can actually hold a great deal of miscellaneous information. We always check for the SIM card as a means to make sure that this phone is actually able to connect to a cellular network.
Did you see one here?
I did.
And then do you also check to see if there's enough battery power?
Absolutely.
What do you do if there's not?
If we receive a phone that is either powered, has low power, or is actually the battery is completely dead, we will connect it to a power source to power to recharge the battery. The processes that we do required the phone to be able to be powered on, so we needed a, you know, charge battery.
All right, so in 183, you are able to get to where you would normally put in a passcode. Do you sometimes not have passcodes?
Absolutely.
Is it easier when you do?
It much easier.
So did you try the 000 here?
We did.
Zero. I think I left one out. Were you able to get into the phone?
We were.
184. Why do you take a photo of that?
We're just documenting what is visible on the screens, what icons, what applications are installed on the phone.
So you're seeing that there have been phone calls that have been missed and mail that's
correct
going on. And then 185, what is the relevance of this? What does this tell us?
That is simply information on the phone itself. What you are looking at, if it were able to connect to a network, you would see the network information there. This is obviously a phone that was associated with the Verizon cellular network. The IMEI and the ICCID and MEID are identifiers for the cellular networks. The network, the carrier, and all of that information is just to help identify the device.
Okay. And so that is able to be confirmed when you look at the phone itself, 245?
Correct.
Okay. So in this case, after you got this powered up, what'd you do to and took those photographs, documenting what you're doing, what'd you do?
Once we had taken the photographs, we'd ensured everything. The phone was in airplane mode. In this particular case, I used a device called a gray key device. I attached the phone to this gray key device and configured it to conduct what is called a full file system extraction of the iPhone. a full file system extraction is pretty much the best copy that we can make. It copies all the data off the phone, including anything in deleted space, any user files, any system files. It pretty much copies everything that's on the phone for us to examine later.
Okay. Now, does technology continue to improve in our world?
All the time.
So you did this in 2019, right?
Correct.
So whatever the newer technology is not the same as what it may have been back then.
That would be fair to say, yes.
In terms of technology, have you seen changes in Breakey and Cellebrite over the years that you were using it?
I did.
And as each new version came out, did that ever cause you to find that data was wrongly recovered, or just that there was more data recovered?
In my experience, I never observed that changes in the software, updates to the software, would result in previously found data being changed or omitted or deleted or in anything like that. What we would find is it would change the format and how that information was presented. On occasion, as things really did change and bigger versions came out, sometimes it would have the capability to acquire additional information that maybe it could not acquire prior.
So maybe it was better at finding deleted items or parsing things together.
Correct.
Okay. Do you recall about how long that process took to use the gray key to extract that full file system?
As I recall, it was approximately 1 hour.
So after you use the gray key, is that where sort of everything's jumbled in a box?
Correct. That's the gray key created that single container file with everything from the phone inside of it.
So did you use something else at that point to allow detectives and other people to be able to access and look for specific things?
I did. Once we have that single container file, I took that file and I opened it up in a program called Cellebrite Physical Analyzer. That physical analyzer software is what went through that container file and put everything in a more readable format for detectives or whoever else needed to view the contents of the phone.
So that then allowed detectives or others to go into this new report that allowed you to look at a section that had just photos or a section that just had emails.
Correct.
After you use that Cellebrite to parse out all that data into these different sections, did you conduct any research on that phone?
Or I did not.
Did you look through any of that Cellebrite report?
I did not.
Did you analyze or review any of the data?
I did not.
Did you provide the detectives who then had been working on the case with that to review themselves?
What we would do, since the Cellebrite physical analyzer software was very expensive and actually required a key in order to use, the Cellebrite software allowed us to create what we referred to as a reader file, which is a file that they can open in a program called Cellebrite Reader, happily enough, and that would allow them to review the data in a free software platform.
So as long as you had the reader, you could then go through all the data that the Cellebrite had parsed into these readable formats.
Correct. Anything that was included in when I imported the file or uploaded the file into the physical analyzer software, any information that was in the physical analyzer software was copied and included in the reader file.
Did that end your involvement with Exhibit 245, that phone?
I'm sorry, one more time?
Did that end your involvement with Exhibit 245, that iPhone?
Aside from making sure that any files that we created, any pictures that were taken were securely stored, it did.
All right. Thank you. I have no other questions.
Cross.
Questions, Your Honor.
I'm sorry. Did you say no questions?
No questions.
All right. Any questions from any member of the jury? I see at least one. Okay. The question is, if someone were to delete their browser history, can you still pull the history?
On occasion. Browser history and any internet data like that, especially on cell phones, over time, if it's been deleted, it can be overwritten. However, if it is more recent, and sometimes by recent, we are actually talking within the last year or so, that information, regardless of it being deleted, can be recovered by the software.
Follow-up from the defense based on that question?
No.
State?
No, Your Honor.
All right, sir, you can step down. Thank you.
Thank you.
State can call its next witness.
Thank you.
All right, ma'am, you're going to come right up, stand right in front of the wall here, right here.
Can you spell your name for the record?
Yes, Marissa Francisco, M-A-R-R-I-S-A, last name F-R-A-N-C-I-S-C-O.
You do solemnly swear the testimony you're about to give will be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God.
Yes,
all right, you're going to walk around the court reporter. I have a seat just to my left here.
Would you please introduce yourself to the jury?
Yes, my name is Marissa Francisco, and I am a forensic scientist with the City of Chandler in the Forensic Services section.
How long have you worked there?
I have worked there since August of 2018. Previous to that, I was employed at the Arizona Department of Public Safety, and I started there in 2004.
So let's kind of go back. What did you do at the Department of Public Safety, DPS?
I started my career in the blood alcohol unit. So my duty there was to test blood for the presence of alcohol. I was in that unit for about 7 years. After that, I transferred to the trace evidence unit, where I was trained to do hair comparisons and fiber comparisons. After that, about 2016, 2017, I started training in the latent print unit. In August 2018, I completed my training at the City of Chandler and have been doing latent print analysis primarily at the City of Chandler.
Can you tell us the training and your education to be a latent print analyst?
Yes. I have a Bachelor's of Science in Biochemistry from the University of California at Los Angeles, and a Master's of Science in Forensic Science from the University of Illinois at Chicago. As part of my training for latent prints, it was an extensive year and a half long program where there was readings, lectures, comparison exercises, oral boards, and a competency test. I also have to conduct and complete a proficiency test on latent print comparisons on an annual basis. I am also a certified latent print examiner. In order to obtain the certification, I had to complete over 160 hours of certified training and pass a comprehensive exam.
Thank you. I'm going to start sort of really general. Can you tell us what latent prints are?
Yes. Latent, by definition, is something that is present but not visible. So a latent print is an impression, a friction ridge detail that is not readily visible. Some processing techniques that can be chemical or physical are needed to help visualize those latent prints.
So we talk about latent prints, we're thinking of people's fingers. Where do we find latent prints on people?
Yes, let me start with defining what friction ridge skin is. Friction ridge skin are raised ridges the palms of our hands and the soles of our feet. They are specialized and only located in those two areas. We often have oils and sweat and other residues on our hands, and when we touch an item, we can leave an impression of our friction ridge detail on that item.
Is that what most of us call latent prints, or I left a print behind?
Yes, fingerprints.
You started to talk about oils and things. Do people always leave behind a print if they touch an object?
It actually depends on a lot of different things. First off, the amount of oils and residues on our hands will determine whether an impression is left. Also, the deposition pressure, meaning are we gently tapping on something or are we like really pushing down on it, that will affect whether an impression is left and the quality of that print. The item itself is very important. Is it something that is receptive to prints? Items that are smooth, like glass, I am more likely to find a print on an item like that versus something that is textured and rough, like a cinder block. I would not expect to find a laying print on a cinder block. The condition of the item, is also important. How many people may have come in contact with that item. All these different things affect whether an impression is left and the quality of that impression. We can very simply think of a stamp, our fingers being the stamps, the oils being the ink, and depending on how the stamp is placed on different items will determine how that impression looks.
Can environment also impact the quality of or whether or not a print remains?
Yes. The environment is also important. After a print is left, is it left out to the conditions of rain or does it get wet? Is there a dust storm? Is it in an area that it has high traffic? Like if a fingerprint is left on a door to a convenience store and 100 people go through there that day, impressions are left, but if I lift those prints, I might not be able to identify them because there are so many prints on top of each other.
And sure, that goes to the next thing. So are prints something that once you make it, it's permanent and there forever?
It is there until it is disturbed, so it can be there forever.
Can we wipe them away?
Yes.
Can they be smudged away?
They can, yes.
So can someone rubbing an object, like a smooth object, get rid of that?
Yes.
Are there different ways or different processes that you use to obtain latent prints or friction ridge detail off of an object?
Yes, there are. First off, I want to define what a non-porous item is. A non-porous item is an item where water or air cannot pass through it. So when I first receive an item, I determine whether it is porous or non-porous because depending on that, I will use different processing techniques.
So for a non-porous item, what processes do you use to try to find friction-rich detail?
Yes. On non-porous items, the main processing technique that I use is called cyanoacrylate fuming, more commonly known as superglue fuming. So items are exposed to superglue fumes, and the fumes react to any oils and sweat in the latent print, creating a white visible print that is not readily destroyed.
So you've looked at the non-porous item. You don't see any prints on it. Do you look visually first?
Yes, sorry. The very first thing we do is I look at the request sheet and see what items are needing to be tested in that case. And also I look to see what the requesting officer wants done with the case. Sometimes they are requesting that the item be swabbed for DNA. If an item is requested to be swabbed for DNA, I have to use clean techniques to help reduce and limit contamination. So clean techniques are when I bleach down all surfaces with bleach, I lay down a clean butcher paper, I use sterile equipment. I'm only analyzing and working with one item at a time, and I'm changing gloves between items to help prevent contamination. So if a request sheet requests DNA evidence, I will have to use clean techniques to before I swab the item for DNA. After that, I will do a visual examination of the item. Before any processing techniques are conducted, I will take a flashlight and look at the item to see if I can see any latent prints with a flashlight. If I can see a visible print at this point, depending on the quality of that print, I will take a picture or lift that latent before I move on to any processes. So after each processing technique, I will have to document what I find with either photography, scanning on a scanner, or lifting with powder.
So you talked about photographing these latent prints. How do you do that? Like how do you take a photograph of that to ensure it's the right size or shape or whatever so you can later use it for a comparison?
Yes, I have training and experience in taking photographs. So in the photograph, I have to have a scale in it. So I have a scale with the case number, and I am just trained to properly use the lighting I need, adjust the lighting, focus it correctly, have it level with the lens of the camera, and I take a picture and document where on the item the photograph was taken.
Okay. So how do you, you just told us you document where on the item the picture was taken. How do you do that so that you can later go back and say it's in the middle of a mirror or whatever it might be?
Yes. I try to be as clear and concise as possible because, like I said, I have to take a picture after every single step. So I have to take a picture if there is any latent print of the visible step. And then if I go on to doing the super glue fuming, I have to take a picture of that same latent. If I go on to another process called dye staining, which we apply a fluorescent dye to even better visualize the image, I have to take that same latent again. So it helps me out to be able to go to find that latent. So I try to be specific on where that latent was found.
Do you, when you are processing a non-porous item and you find what I'll call a partial print or something that looks like friction ridge detail, do you collect it or do you say right then and there, I don't think that would be useful?
Yes. So when I am examining an item, at that stage, my conclusions are either no latents observed, meaning I didn't see any friction ridge detail at all, no value latents, meaning I did see some friction ridge detail, but I don't believe that I can do anything or compare them at a later point, or latents for analysis. So if I find sufficient, clear latent print detail, I will take a picture of it. If I'm not sure, I go ahead and take a picture of it because at this point, I am not really determining whether the print is identifiable. I am just saying that I'm taking this picture and I want to do further analysis on it at a later point.
So then for the analysis, are you then, after you process an item and you recover any latent prints that may be useful or which are you later asked to ever compare those recovered prints to known prints?
Yes.
What do we mean by a known print?
Yes. So a known print is known fingerprints that are collected from an individual. They're typically recorded electronically or with ink. So in my comparisons, I am always comparing a latent impression that was recovered or developed versus a exemplar, and I'm trying to determine whether or not the latent could have originated from that exemplar, or whether or not those two impressions could have been made by the same individual.
Can you tell us briefly, when you are looking at this recovered latent print and comparing it to a known, what are you looking for to be able to make an identification?
I will explain what methodology we use for latent print comparisons. It is called ACE-V, which stands for Analysis, Comparison, Evaluation, and Verification. So in the analysis phase, I'm taking an assessment of the latent and the exemplar and determining whether or not they are suitable for comparison. If I determine they are suitable for comparison, I move on to the comparison phase. This is when I'm observing two impressions and I'm looking for the existence of similarities, differences, or discrepancies. Next is the evaluation phase. At this point, I am rendering a conclusion based on my analysis and comparison. The three different conclusions that can be reached are identification, exclusion, and inconclusive. So identification is the determination that the two impressions originated from the same person. Exclusion is the determination that the two impressions, the latent and the known, were not created by the same individual or they do not have the same source. Lastly, I have a conclusion of inconclusive, and this is where I can neither identify nor exclude the individual from having made the print. So going back to analysis, during the analysis phase, I am looking at a lot of different things. First off, I'm trying to determine, is the print from a finger or is it from part of the palm? And also I'm determining the orientation of the print. If it's from the palm, I can also, depending on the ridge flow in the latent print, I can determine what area of the palm it came from. I'm looking at the shape of the impression. Like sometimes you have like a C-shaped impression and that's this part of the palm. So this is called the writer's palm, and that's where I would look first when I'm doing a comparison. So besides that, I am looking at level 1, level 2, and level 3 detail. Level 1 detail is the actual flow or pattern of the ridges. Our fingers have three main patterns, which are loops, whorls, and arches. Next, I'm looking at second level detail. I'm looking at the ridge characteristics. So I'm looking at where the ridges end, which we call ridge endings. I'm examining where ridges split into two ridges, which are called bifurcations. And I'm marking any dots, which are very short ridges. So I'm examining the latent, and I'm marking up all these second level details so that I can later compare to the exemplar. I'm also noting if there's any scars present in the latent. I'm noting if there's some creases or if there are issues with the deposition pressure or if there seems to be some movement in the latent. I'm documenting all of that stuff in the analysis phase of my analysis.
Let me leave that with her.
Okay. Yep.
do recognize Exhibit 249 as an item that you were provided and asked to process to see if you could recover any latent prints or friction ridge detail. Sorry. And it's a little awkward.
Yes, I do recognize this item.
And were you provided with that Exhibit 249, that bat, and asked to try to recover any latent prints from that bat?
Yes, I was.
Can you tell us, in this Exhibit 249, what did you do to attempt to recover any, and did you recover any latent prints?
Yes. On the request, it was also requested that I process the item with clean techniques because it was also requested that I swab the item for DNA. So I already went through that process and explained that. So I used clean techniques to process this item. And the very first thing I did when I opened up the packaging was I swabbed the textured grip for potential DNA. The reason I swabbed the grip first is because of the texture on that grip, I would not expect to find latent prints on the grip. So I didn't feel that I was potentially ruining any prints because I don't feel that there would be fingerprints on that textured grip. So that was the very first thing I did. And then I did a visual examination of the bat with a flashlight to see if there were any visible prints at that point. And I don't believe there were, but I would have to check my notes.
But looking at your notes, help refresh your recollection as to whether or not you did find anything there.
Yes.
Do you have your notes up with you?
Yes.
If you want to take a look at those and then let us know when you're done if that has refreshed your recollection. That refresh your recollection?
Yes. So at the visible stage, my conclusion was that there were no latents observed at the visual stage.
I'm going to put Exhibit 35 up here just so that we can all kind of see what we're talking about. So the gripped part here is what you were talking about that you swabbed because you did not believe that prints would be recoverable on that texture that was on bat?
Correct.
Okay. So then you visually look, you don't observe any latent prints or friction ridge detail?
Correct.
What did you do next?
I then use a processing technique of superglue fuming.
And when you used that process, did you locate or recover any latent prints or friction ridge detail?
Yes, I did.
Can you tell us how many and where?
Yes, I recovered two impressions that I took pictures of, and I would have to look at my notes to refresh where they were collected from.
If looking at your notes would help refresh as to where you located those, please do so, and then let us know when you've been refreshed.
I'm ready.
Where did you locate those two?
The first one was recovered in the W of the Rawlings that was above the diameter. I think Rawlings is also on the other side. So that's why I stated that it was the one that was right above where the diameter is. Okay. And the second one was recovered in between the G and the diameter.
Now, you told us that what you are recovering can isn't always look like a finger, right? When you were recovering these latent prints, were you able to tell by just recovering them if it was a finger or, like you told us, a palm? When you looked at it, were you able to immediately identify where they came from?
They appear to be fingerprints.
Was there anything about the shape or, I guess, the shape of them that made you think that they were fingerprints?
The first image, it was just the shape of the impression just indicated to me that it was a fingerprint. The size of it indicated to me that it was a fingerprint.
Was the other one, the second print, slightly, I guess, not as clear on whether or not it was a fingerprint or potentially from some other area?
Correct. Okay.
Were you asked to then compare those two? Well, let me ask you, when you obtained these two, you told us there were three different levels. Obviously, you collected something. Did you believe these were able to make identifications, or what did you determine about the clarity, the detail of those two recovered prints?
For both impressions, in my analysis, I determined that both impressions were NVID, which stands for no value for identification. This means that the latents lack sufficient clarity, quantity, or uniqueness to identify, but may be suitable for exclusion. So the impressions were possibly excludable, but I would not be able to identify who made those impressions.
So were you initially asked to try to identify them to three individuals?
Yes, I was first asked to compare the two impressions to three individuals.
And who were those three individuals?
Could I look at my notes, please?
Yes, if that would help refresh your recollection.
Yes, I was initially asked to compare the three impressions to a Charles Vallow, a Lori Vallow, and an Alexander Cox.
So you told us, though, they were of no value for identification. So did that sort of end that request?
Yes. So when there is only prints that are determined to be no value for identification, we routinely do not compare those prints, but we say, if you still want us to compare it to anyone, please let us know. But initially, we are not going to try to compare NVID prints to any individual because they cannot be identified.
So were you then requested to see if you could make any exclusions?
I was then requested to compare the two impressions to Charles Vallow to see if I can determine whether the two impressions did not originate from Charles Vallow.
Starting with the first impression that you found above the W, but the other side of the bat from what we see in 35 here, where there's a diameter marking, were you able to reach any conclusions in looking at the prints from Charles Vallow and that recovered print?
Again, I went through the ACE-V process, and during the comparison phase and evaluation phase, I determined that the first latent was inconclusive to Charles Vallow, meaning that I could neither identify nor exclude him from having made the impression.
So does that just mean there's just not enough in that print to do anything with?
Correct. So there is not, it lacks sufficient agreement in the detail to identify, and it lacks sufficient disagreement in the impressions to exclude.
And is that common when you have a latent print that just doesn't seem to have the level of detail just necessary for that?
Yes, that is a common conclusion.
So you're not saying it's Charles, you're not saying it's not Charles, you just can't do anything with it?
I could neither identify or exclude Charles Vallow.
So for the second print, did you also attempt to compare that to latent prints from Charles Vallow?
Yes, I did.
And were you able to reach any conclusions as to that?
Yes. My conclusion was that the latent was inconclusive to Charles Vallow due to lack of detail in the latent and exemplar.
Were you ever asked to try to exclude Alex Cox as having made those latent prints?
No. After I initially did not compare the latents to the three individuals on the named comparison, I was only asked to compare the two impressions to Charles Vallow.
So you also weren't asked to try to exclude or secondary compare to a Lori Vallow?
No, I was not.
And were you ever asked to compare to a Tylee Ryan?
No, I was not.
Did that sort of end your processing and comparisons of this bat?
Yes.
Thank you. I have no other questions for this witness.
Cross.
I have one question.
You said earlier that the DNA that you collected, was that ever tested?
I don't know.
Is it sent somewhere else?
Correct. So okay. The city of Chandler does not have the capability to test for DNA. Anytime we swab for DNA, we send it to the state lab for analysis.
So you swabbed it and sent it to the lab, and that was the last you heard of it?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you. That's all.
Any redirect?
No, Your Honor.
Any questions for this witness from any member of the jury? I don't see any, so you can step down, ma'am. I think this is a good time to take our afternoon recess. We'll be at recess for 15 minutes. Please remember the admonition.
All rise for the jury.
There's more live courtroom coverage coming up. Press subscribe now so you don't miss a second from the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today.
I can't tell you how often I hear, oh, I'm a little OCD. I like things neat. That's not OCD. I'm Howie Mandel, and I know this because I have OCD. Actual OCD causes relentless, unwanted thoughts. What if I did something terrible and forgot? What if I'm a bad person? Why am I thinking this terrible thing? It makes you question absolutely everything, and you'll do anything to feel better. OCD is debilitating, but it's also highly treatable with the right kind of therapy. Regular talk therapy doesn't cut it. OCD needs specialized therapy. That's why I want to tell you about NoCD. NoCD is the world's largest virtual therapy provider for OCD. Their licensed therapists provide specialized therapy virtually, and it's covered by insurance for over 155 million Americans. If you think you might be struggling with OCD, visit NoCD.com to schedule a free 15-minute call and learn more. That's NoCD.com.
Sally from finance loves fly fishing. She used to spend her weekend surrounded by receipts. Then she switched her company to Ramp. Now, spend is all under control, all in one place. Her team submits their expenses with a text, and she can close the books without all the busy work. So Sally's weekends are all her own, surrounded by fish, not receipts. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.
You have 5 new messages.
Hey, Carl, it's Jen from Finance. Could you submit your expenses this week?
Hey, Carl, happy Friday. It's Jen, Finance. Just need those receipts today. Me again, Carl. Really need those receipts, like last week. Please just tell me where they are. Are you by your desk right now?
Finance teams, you shouldn't be chasing down Carl or anyone else. With Ramp, expenses are sent with a text and reminders happen automatically. Switch your business to ramp.com today and love finance again.